All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our cozy little room here, and it's good to have so many people here for an event on the CAR. My name is Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Africa Programme here at CSIS. We're here this morning for, I think, a timely conversation on the crisis in Central African Republic, which really shows no sign of abating. I'm sure, looking around to the people in the room, you're all pretty familiar with the broad outlines of the crisis. I won't go through them in detail, but really, we've been in progress since the late 2012, when the Seleka rebellion broke out and swept a few months later Francoise Bozize from power. Seleka going on to wreak havoc on the country, on its majority Christian population in particular. We had, I suppose, a brief glimmer of optimism when Seleka leader Michel Djotodia was persuaded to step down in January. We had a transitional government put in place, but since then the violence has continued, fueled by Christian anti-Balaka militia taking revenge on the Muslim population. We're rapidly moving towards this, having a sort of de facto partition of the country along religious lines. We've convened this discussion this morning because I think it's important to keep the spotlight shining on this ongoing crisis amid the competing claims of other conflicts elsewhere in Africa and the wider world. There's a danger, I think, that once more the plight of those, the people of Central African Republic, is struggling to get the attention it deserves. But this is a critical moment, I think, for several reasons. Not only that has the weight of human suffering been intolerable so far, thousands killed, almost 1 million displaced, and a surge of sectarian animosity that's going to be very difficult to put back into the bottle. But the dimensions of the crisis could be about to expand still further. The rains are coming, placing extra strain on the displaced, who already live in pretty appalling conditions. And furthermore, we've reached an important moment in terms of the international response to this crisis. The UN Security Council last month reached agreement on the stand-up of a UN peacekeeping mission to replace the African Union MISCA force and also the French peacekeepers. But there are big question marks over the ability of this MINUSCA mission to deploy on schedule in September. And plugging the gap between now and then, and possibly even longer, requires planning, initiative, money, and political commitment that we've not really, well, we're only seeing in patchy quantities right now. So this morning we're going to take a look at some of these big questions, think about possible ways forward, hear about the role of the United States in terms of providing some of these solutions. And I want to start the focus of the discussion today by looking at the humanitarian crisis in CAR. And I'm delighted that we've joined this morning by Mark Yarnell of Refugees International. Mark just returned from CAR a few weeks ago after conducting an assessment on the ground. You have the bios of all the speakers this morning, so I won't introduce them at length, but Mark's going to start things off this morning. We'll hear from him, and then I'll turn to Sarah Holowinski, who's Executive Director of the Center for Civilians in Conflict. And then we'll also hear from David Brown, who's the Senior Advisor for Central African Republic at the US State Department. Since last August, he's been coordinating US diplomatic efforts on CAR. And we also have some USAID colleagues in the room who I'll introduce in due course as well. So we've got a lot of expertise here, and delighted you can all join us. So without further ado, I'm going to turn to Mark. But Mark collected some footage on the ground during his trips and has a short video that we're going to show right now before you kick off with the comments.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. I just want to introduce my colleague, Claudia Schott.
Shot the video. Normalement, maintenant, on commence maintenant à vider, puisque c'était devenu maintenant horrible. Hein, c'était horrible. Si c'est une femme, si c'est une femme ou c'est un garçon ou c'est un petit, il tue.
الساعة هم قالوا لي ميدي وعند كالكي لكن الساعة 22 دقيقة ده ولا 2:30 كده خلاص الأتاك خلاص الأنتي مرقوا فوقنا نار روكيت ونار وكلاشات وشنو مرة فوقنا مرة من الساعة 2:30 خلاص الناس دي كلها كمروا هنا من الساعة 2:30 جوني هنا كلها الفما كانت تدحرون في البكان هنا لحد الفما واحد الواحد وقع هنا كتروا هنا الواحد دي هنا كل في جيني هنا كل زرميل هنا في الكون هنا كله يلا هات الفما كتر
One more time. It's a good way to wake up in a Monday morning. As Richard said, I'm Mark Yarnell with Refugees International. And Richard, thanks so much for convening the event, and again, just to keep attention on a situation that unfortunately continues to be extremely difficult to respond to. And obviously, it's great, David Brown and Sarah Lewinsky, to be on a panel with you. And I'll be fairly brief in remarks, just to highlight some of our key findings and some recommendations going forward. But with so many of you in the room who follow the issue closely, really looking forward to having a discussion about what to do going forward, given the complexities. Last week, John Ging, who's the director of operations for UN OCHA, said that the international community has thus far failed the people of Qatar, and I don't disagree. I think that it's tragic what has happened thus far, and so the big question now is how can we prevent the situation from becoming worse and begin to help rebuild. As you saw from the video, there's multiple aspects of the crisis. There's tens of thousands of people still living in displacement camps, and the conditions, you know, prior to the rainy season have been fairly deplorable, and with the rains it only becomes more of a challenge. And so there's an urgent need to not only improve the conditions in those camps and prevent the impact of flooding, but also for their neighborhoods to be safe enough for them to return home. At that camp in Bosangoa that you saw in the video, up in the north of Central African Republic, the people who are in that camp are living literally just a few miles from their homes. But because there's still insecurity in their neighborhoods, don't feel as though they'd rather, you know, live in flooded tents than go back to their neighborhoods. There's also many people who, when the violence hit, especially when the Seleka rebels were moving from the north down to the south to take over the capital, were brutally attacking villages. There are a number of people who felt it was too insecure to flee into IDP camps like the one in Bosangoa, and ended up going straight into the bush and kind of fending for themselves for months at a time. And we met a number of villagers who had just returned to their homes after living a pretty rough existence in the forest. But when they came home, their homes are destroyed, the medical clinics are ransacked, and are in need of some pretty basic support just to get themselves going again. Then in addition to that, as I'm sure all of you have been hearing about, there's pockets of Muslim communities that remain under siege. Many of them have already fled, either under the support of peacekeeping escorts or their own devices, trying to jump onto different convoys that have been leaving the country. But there are still pockets, especially in town of Bota. There's several thousand who are under threat. This is all within a broader context of deteriorating food insecurity. There's been, because of when the violence initiated, it affected a planting season last March. There's people who are still displaced now who can't engage in planting, and even those who are returned often have lost their tools or their seeds. Also, given the significant role of Muslim population in the trading sector and in market systems, the fact that so many Muslims have fled has had a major impact on functioning markets. I think it goes without saying that the funding is under-resourced. That's something that's constantly highlighted in the situation in CAR. But I think it needs to continue to be highlighted just because if there aren't enough resources, no matter how complex the situation is, we can't even begin to address some of the challenges. Right now, the UN estimates that it's only received about 29% of what is needed for an adequate response to the crisis. One thing that's quite discouraging is that some countries or government institutions like the European Commission made some pretty significant pledges on the humanitarian side, but a lot of that money has failed to come through. The EU is about $50 million short of what they'd pledged. The UK is about $11 million short. Fortunately, the US has come through with a significant amount of funding, about $66 million, I believe, on the humanitarian side, which is extremely important. And also, I think the fact there have been a number of high-level visits to CAR by government officials from State Department, different members of Congress. I know David Brown was there just recently. Something that we're continuing to push on, though, and I'll be very interested to hear an update on, is when it might be possible to reopen the embassy in Bangui. There hasn't been a presence, full-time U.S. embassy presence in Bangui, I believe, since December 2012, yeah. And not only is it important for the political elements of U.S. government to be reopened, but that could also facilitate U.S. aid staff from being present in the country. And in a situation where the context on the ground is changing so quickly, one area that's accessible one week becomes inaccessible the next, or a situation like Bangui where you have people beginning to return home because the situation stabilizes and then there's another uptick in violence and they rush back into the camps, to have donor agencies present to be able to engage directly with beneficiaries and engage directly with partners, I think would help improve the effectiveness of the response. Just a note about peacekeeping. I know that Sarah will go into more detail. Even though, as David mentioned, even though the UN Security Council has approved a UN peacekeeping mission, it won't be stood up until middle of September this year. And in the meantime, I think there's concern that there'll be a lot more violence and a lot more damage to the country. So a big question is what can be done in the immediate term to help the peacekeepers who are on the ground now and improve protection of civilians. There is an African Union troop, MISCA, which is there, but it's quite under-resourced. And from our conversations with villagers and from our travel north, it was clear that the ability for MISCA just logistically to travel wide and to have a broad coverage was difficult. And so there's basic things like trucks and enough gasoline. There's been reports that MISCA soldiers have very poor sanitation facilities. Just getting some very basic support to improve MISCA, since they're on the ground now, I think would make a big difference. And then secondly, there's a European force which is meant to be deployed. And there's been discussions about this since January, of this year. The latest figures I saw, and correct me if I'm wrong, is 150 of the expected 800 troops have arrived. And so it's been extremely slow to deploy. So I think, especially from the U.S. side, interested to hear your discussions with the European counterparts about deploying those troops more quickly. And then finally, even though it could take up until September 4, or it will be September 15th when the UN peacekeeping mission is established and the troops from the African Union are rehatted to the blue-helmeted UN peacekeepers, there still is an opportunity to get the civilian side of the mission on the ground faster, getting political affairs officers, risk mitigation officers. One important part is improving relations between MISCA, the peacekeepers, and the community. And so the faster there can be staff who have the capacity to engage in community liaison in building a bridge between local communities and the peacekeepers, we think that will be helpful not only for MISCA, but also transitioning to the peacekeeping force. The folks in Bosangoa that had quite a high turnover of contingents, there was initially troops from Congo who were there, and then they rotated out, and then there were troops from France and Chad, and then they left, and now there's troops from Cameroon who are there, and there seemed to be a great deal of confusion over why there was those kinds of rotations, what the mandate of the mission is, what civilians can expect out of the peacekeeping mission. So whatever can be done to improve those kinds of engagements will be quite important. So I'm just going to leave it there. But again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and for convening the event. And obviously we have some more details in our policy report. So I'll give it over to Sarah. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Mark. And over to you, Sarah. Let's.
I'm happy to just talk to the room like this. Is it easier if I have a mic?
Only because we're audio recording this on our website as well. So that's the best way you'll get heard. That's probably close.
Yeah. It should be fine. Okay, I'll try to speak very loudly and yell at you about CAR, fortunately. So I was there in late March, early April, and with a group that included my managing director and also the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, two representatives from there, and also the Stimson Center, Allison Giffen, who I'm sure many of you know, tremendous peacekeeping expert. So as we got on the plane in Paris to go to Bangui, there was a significant uptick in violence. And so that entire week, we really saw what Bangui had to offer its civilians. We weren't able to get outside of Bangui because of that violence. And in fact, one of the days we were stuck at the hotel, which actually made for very interesting conversations with MISCA, who was staying at the same hotel. So we got some really great intelligence on that. I think I'm going to go very deep into some protection of civilians concerns and recommendations, and then come back up for a couple of overarching big picture concerns that I have. On protection of civilians, it's a term that is thrown around Washington and New York and in the field. Nobody really knows what it means, or everyone thinks it means something different. So the three definitions of POC that I see, one being the humanitarian protection of civilians, which I'm not going to get into, humanitarian community aid, that sort of thing. The other two I will get into. One version of protection of civilians is, I believe, what the mandate means for CAR and their peacekeeping forces, which is the proactive protection of civilians, putting themselves between the threat and the civilian. There is also another version of POC that my organization in particular works on with warring parties and peacekeepers, and that is harm mitigation, meaning when you are going as a peacekeeper to proactively protect civilians, how can you avoid causing harm to civilians? Let me pick up on that second one first, since it's what I know best. MISCA forces want to proactively protect civilians. Unlike a lot of the peacekeeping forces that we all know from history, where they don't use their weapons, they're on their bases, they never go out into communities, MISCO forces feel like they have something to prove. They want to be the African Union's regional solution to this conflict, and they are using their weapons, and they are going out, and they are trying to protect civilians. They don't necessarily have the training to do this, but I applaud them for their courage and their desire to go do this, particularly because they are woefully under-resourced. So there are a couple of things that MISCA needs immediately in order to do their job well while not harming civilians. And I bring this up because there is a concern for MISCA's legitimacy going forward between now and September, but also after September, as they are rehatted as a UN peacekeeping force. They cannot cause harm to civilians. This will be to the detriment of the African Union. It will also be, unfortunately, a detriment to the bravery of these folks who have gone there with their weapons trying to protect civilians. So a few things that they could use immediately, a civilian harm mitigation advisor, all of these things I can give you more detail about in the written word. It's probably not useful to take up time here. A civilian harm mitigation advisor that reports directly to the force commander. They could use a defensive fire policy. Burundian forces in particular, and we saw this in Somalia too, when they are attacked, and they will be increasingly attacked in Bangui and elsewhere, fire back without knowing what they're firing at. And they have killed civilians. They basically fire into crowds. This is easily fixed with a proper policy, with proper rules of engagement, but these are the things that nobody is necessarily paying attention to. They certainly need, and this is one of my big recommendations to the United States because it does it so well, strategic communications. One thing that Mark mentioned was that the population doesn't necessarily know what MISCA is there to do, where they're going to be operating, what that means for their own protection in their own communities, what they can expect. All of these things are incredibly important, not only for MISCA's legitimacy and then being rehatted, but for the civilian populations themselves. If you are under attack and you have this force coming in, how do you protect yourself? You need to know what that force is doing and what it's there to do. So for self-protection, there needs to be better communication with the population. I will also discuss the proactive protection of civilians, and this is where we get into mandate issues. The mandate itself is actually very good. We were a little bit worried that the UN was going to say, okay, there's this massive problem, there's the protection of civilians, there's security concerns, there's the state building aspect, and they were just going to lump it all in together and try to do it all at once. It's a fairly staged mandate, and for that, I think we're all grateful. Alison Giffen has amazing recommendations on this stuff that get very nitty-gritty if you want to flood her inbox while she's in DR Congo right now asking her about it. There are some things that DPKO needs to do immediately and needs to do not only immediately with regard to the mandate coming up on September 15th, but now, and they're waiting. I don't know if it's stalling, I don't know if it's resources, it seems to all be in the planning process, but they're not going fast enough. And some of these things include reconciliation efforts. Those are already being funded. USAID is doing a tremendous job with Search for Common Ground and Mercy Corps and some of these others. UN also needs to be paying attention to this, building out the radio capabilities so that you actually can have a strategic communication effort within the country that can help not only with reconciliation, but with preparing the population for the UN Peace Operations Force that's going to come in. Security for state officials, the officials that we met with, ministers, high-ranking justice officials, are fearing for their lives on a daily basis. They have to go home at 2 p.m. because they can't be out after that because they will get attacked. I mean, there are things that they need immediately in order to do their jobs and have some sort of state function. And then the thing that overlaps between both proactive protection of civilians and civilian harm mitigation is training. And African Union forces are trained, yes, on the letter of the law. Some may be able to tell you what the Geneva Conventions are. They're able to use their weapons. What about protection of civilians? What about when you have 6 seconds to decide whether somebody coming at you is a civilian or a combatant? They need scenario-based training, and they need to do it over and over and over again so that they don't harm civilians and that they can actually protect the population. There are really good examples of this kind of training that the US, UK, Australia, others have, particularly from Afghanistan, that is very applicable in Central African Republic. So let's get that in there, not only pre-deployment, but in theater training. And then for the two last comments, these are big picture concerns. As I mentioned, MISCA has a lot of pride in going to Central African Republic. The AU wants, as I said, to be seen as a regional solution to these types of conflicts. It needs to be resourced to do so, and it needs to not have a back seat when it comes to planning for the UN rehatted peace operation. I talked with high-level MISCA officials, and they are very worried about being taken out of the leadership, basically sidelined by the UN. This has happened over and over again. There's this tension between the AU and the UN, but it does have ramifications for civilians who have to live through this conflict when there isn't the kind of coordination and there isn't the kind of empowered leadership from the AU that we need to see. And then finally, yes, it is a conflict between Christians and Muslims, but this is not a conflict between Muhammad and Jesus. That's not what this is. And without understanding fully that this is about political and economic disenfranchisement between two communities who happen to be Muslim and Christian, I'm not sure that we're going to actually get to the root causes of the problem. The mandate itself may take care of immediate security concerns. And I am so glad that the United States is focused on this conflict as it needs to be. However, in talking with a lot of US officials, a lot of EU officials, not David, but others, I have not been able to get a clear answer on what the interest is in CAR. Maybe it's jihadists, maybe it's regional instability, maybe it's a humanitarian cause that we're interested in this. But there is no state in CAR. So if you're actually looking to get at the root causes of the problem and you're actually looking to create a stable place for these civilians, there needs to be a state. And that aspect is what, 30 years, 50 years? What is the investment from the international community? Is it just to quell the violence now and then we're all going to turn away? So that is a very big concern for me, sort of getting a straight answer from the international community on what the priorities are and what the interest is so that we know, so that civilians, more importantly, in CAR know what the future is going to look like. Thanks.
Thank you very much for this invitation today. There's really so much to talk about. I'm going to try and limit my comments because I think the most useful parts of discussions like this are the questions and answers. First, regarding the reopening of the embassy, we're working a great level of detail on reopening and in a very near future. There's a decision that needs to be taken within our department, and so I can't provide details. But you may be hearing about this in the very near future. I think it's very important that we be present again, not only to understand, have better ground truth, to be able to coordinate better with the host government and with donors on the ground. And also, symbolically, it's important, I think, not only that there be an American presence in the form of our embassy, but that our diplomats be out in the country. I praise the French ambassador who was gone outside of Bangui recently, and I think that whoever heads our mission there in the future should be doing the same. In terms of what our national interests are, our national interests in CAR, the Obama administration has made the prevention of mass atrocities and genocide a core national security interest, and some observers state that the CAR is a test case of that. And so that's a very important national interest for us in the Central African Republic. Obviously, others are include the humanitarian, alleviating humanitarian suffering, assisting with the democratic governance, the political transition, so that, and indeed also getting at the core issue of grievances between the different communities. And I fully agree that certainly this conflict at its core was not about religion. It's taken on a religious hue, but that's not fundamentally what it is about. Regional instability is another concern, including the creation of ungoverned spaces that have already allowed the LRA to operate in the eastern part of the country. We don't have any evidence that extremists have moved in the Central African Republic and the rest of the country, but that is a concern. Obviously, in other parts not far away, in Nigeria and northern Cameroon, there have been concerns about what Boko Haram has done there. Now, the current situation, the bigger picture of the security situation, is troubling. I would put it, you saw the film that Mark showed, I would put it in terms of three phases. Well, phase zero could be your prior to the Seleka arrival. The Seleka would describe that as phase one, and that lasted, I would say, until roughly the December period when the Anti-Balaka really started to come on the ascendancy. Jatoja was indeed persuaded to leave power. And that's Anti-Balaka, unfortunately, I think more than many people expected, have really been problematic, have worsened the tendency to seek revenge instead of reconciliation. And what I'm concerned about now is that we may be entering a third phase, and it may have already started, which is to say Seleka and Anti-Balaka fighting with each other. Obviously, we do have a de facto situation of ethno-religious partition of the country, but we're seeing clashes now. The Sangaris and Miska forces have moved out into a third phase of their military operations, advanced as far as Bria, and pretty much stopped for the rainy season. But how is this going to develop in the coming months in terms of the conflict between the two main protagonist groups, which are not monolithic by any means, and we could talk more about our perceptions of who exactly they are, if you wish. So I think we are in a sort of race against time on multiple ways. The transition from MISCA to MINUSCA, the civilian component, of course, started officially with the adoption of Resolution 2149, but the military security aspect of it won't start until September 15th. The troops that are supposed to be generated are 10,000 troops, 1,800 police. The total UN mission is supposed to increase from one, which was approximately 150, I believe, before this conflict started, to 14,000 if you consider the police and the police and the military along with UN-related civilians. That's a great expansion. That would be difficult to carry out in any circumstance. In the circumstances of the Central African Republic, that's an organizational challenge, which is tremendous. So I think we need to be as supportive as we can of the United Nations while recognizing the very challenging operational conditions in which they're operating. Another race for time is the reestablishment of state authority and resources for the government for that. During the Jatoja period, where the Seleka were in power in the international community, I think there was a justifiable, understandable reluctance And I'm not talking about the humanitarian area. I'm talking about political transition and governance to provide resources to a government that had come to power through non-democratic means, in which, in the name of its fighters, a lot of atrocities were being carried out. Fortunately, Jatoja stepped down on January 10th, and we have a new government, transitional government, which is not recognized by the United States, but which is strongly supported unofficially by the United States. We're at the cusp, and it's already started, of the government finally having resources to do something. It has received approximately $30 million from Angola and the Republic of Congo. The World Bank has started funding money for the government. There will be budgetary support from the bank. The IMF is having a vote this month on a rapid credit facility of a little over $20 million. France is talking about budgetary support. And, of course, the European Union is doing the same. And that will allow, there's already been payment of some salary arrears. The program moving forward to the bank will allow salaries to be paid from May to August, and both the fund and the bank, we are told, are optimistic that the budgetary resources of the government for the rest of this calendar year and hopefully the next calendar year will be sufficient for normal operations. There is some hope that you need to get these resources to the government as fast as possible. Obviously, there's fundamental issues of capacity beyond just paying the salaries. In that regard, there are ongoing talks that will be step by step. I hope acceleration of international cooperation. There will be a meeting later this month in Brussels in preparation for the next international contact group meeting, which in theory is supposed to be held in July. And that will allow donors to expert level and above to discuss along with the host government the way forward in various important areas. One area I think that our government needs to do more in is in what I call the gap area. Essentially, our government has done, a commendable job in terms of allocating up to $100 million to MISCA. And in 2013, it gave $35 million humanitarian assistance, $67 million so far this year. That's over $100 million in humanitarian assistance when you add the two together. But there's this gap where other than $7.5 million, which has been provided for things like community radios and helping in reconciliation, there's a whole slew of issues where we need to do a lot more, and that includes working with donors on elections, the national dialogue, the Constitution, the whole criminal judicial system that runs from police and gendarmes to the magistrate system and the correction system. And right now, the country is in a state of anarchy. Think back in my philosophy class, and I think this country is one of the, it's a dystopian situation that is, in the modern day, closest to, you know, Hobbesian state of nature, if you will. It's really that level of lack of state control, lack of any ability to enforce the law, and a state where this cycle of hatred has caused so much pain, death, and suffering. And so we really need to work with the Central African government to address that. There's already been a pilot project that the EU and I believe it's UNDP have worked on to vet and train and partially equip through non-lethal equipment 480 police and gendarmes. We were told by the government at least three months ago, that they have, in theory, 2,500 police and gendarmes who are ready to serve again. Ultimately, as an international community, we need to be thinking not only of reinforcing the UNPKO, which is extremely important, but also assisting the CAR government in rebuilding capacity. And so that's in that area. we're going to be, we've found a certain amount of money that we're going to be working with other donors to assist in the criminal justice system. another area within that system that needs a lot of work is the correction system. The government has worked with international assistance to fix up at least one prison. I know they're working on a women's prison, and they've focused on a men's prison. But we've had a series of breakouts because the people guarding the prisons, who are historically been part of FACA, have not done their job for various reasons. I think it's a combination of fear and corruption. And in any event, that the UN is looking at the issue of UN officials helping to take over, essentially, the correction system, helping with magistrates, and, of course, assisting with the police and gendarmes. I think at that point, I will stop. There's so much to talk about, and so I'd prefer to end it here. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, David, and three excellent presentations. I want to open things up to questions, but before I do so, I want to give the first chance. We have USAID in the room as well to talk about the humanitarian situation. Cara Christie is from the Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. Cara, I just wanted to see if you have anything to add and talk a little bit about USAID's role in addressing the humanitarian crisis. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. And I'll also try to keep the remarks brief, both in the interest of broader discussion, but also because I think most of the issues have already been addressed by the main speakers. From USAID's perspective, I'll just highlight some of our concerns that are in the immediate term, and then speak to a couple of broader issues. Obviously, this is a stark crisis that is not yet abating. I would say among our concerns are certainly the numbers of people that have been affected to date, with more than half of the entire population of the country requiring humanitarian assistance. There is extreme and almost always indiscriminate violence targeting really anyone who happens to be in the way. The topic of civilian protection was addressed in detail, and I'm very appreciative of especially delineating the different aspects of protection. On the humanitarian side, one thing that I'll just add to that discussion is that in addition to the violence and concerns about insufficient protection for populations, we've also heard from a number of our partners that the sexual and gender-based violence incidents is alarming. It seems to be increasing, and it's often, I think, overshadowed by the other group-on-group violence involving the Seleka and Balaka groups. So just wanted to flag that as well. Mark referenced kind of what's coming next in terms of the rainy season. We are also very concerned about this for a number of reasons. In no particular order, concerns about what the harvest will bring. Insecurity, population displacement, and other constraints have likely hindered the ability of most small shareholder farmers to adequately plant for this season. And this is a population that relies heavily on their own planting for subsistence. So we'll be watching the upcoming impact on food security for the entire population of the country. We're also concerned about the impact that rains will have on the populations that are displaced, currently sheltering in sites that are really not habitable in these kinds of heavy rain periods. And then third is an operational constraint. CAR is already an extremely expensive arena to operate in for humanitarian assistance due to the insecurity and the violence, the unpredictable nature of being able to plan humanitarian services given you don't know when you'll be able to travel, as well as the heavy reliance on air operations and flights rather than ground travel. Again, this is due to insecurity, but it's also due to really the lack of infrastructure. And during the heavy rains period, that just increases even more so, with roads becoming impassable and even more reliance on that costly and limited access to air flights. To go up just a higher level kind of overall concerns. I'll flag that this immediate crisis is happening on the backdrop of really a pretty impoverished nation. Again, lack of infrastructure. As an example, among some of our chief medium-term concerns is the health system and infrastructure. What had been present from a state-run health system has virtually collapsed, with staff unable to present to provide services, health clinics that have been virtually looted of anything that could be lifted out and carried out of the building and, in fact, out of the country entirely in some cases. Again, all of this compounds the need for resources, the need for access, the need for sustained assistance and attention. It's been mentioned a couple of times, the U.S. government humanitarian response to date, so glad our information is getting out there. I'll just close by saying we do remain very committed to responding to the humanitarian needs in CAR. We continue to evaluate the conditions and are also eager to have a hopeful resumed presence in order to continue our engagement there. And to that point about the need for sustained assistance and attention, we'll also echo the thanks and appreciation to this group and all of your colleagues for really continuing to keep the spotlight on this crisis. It is obviously not the only one ongoing in the world today, but it just underscores even more so the need for these kinds of dialogues. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Cara. Well, look, we've had a really comprehensive overview there from our four speakers. I'm going to open it straight up to questions. Let's take two or three at a time, and then our panelists can pitch in as and when they wish, unless you have a specific question for a specific speaker. Please identify yourself, and let's start here and work our way around.
Hi, my name is Donna Wells. Why do we think the conflict hasn't attracted extremists? Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, so there's a sort of trio of security-related questions to start us off. So the issue of policing, why no extremism yet? Do we have to throw that into the mix as well? And the overall strategy, military-wise. So, David, perhaps you want to go first.
Okay. In terms of the police and gendarmes, I am only aware of 480 police and gendarmes who have been as part of a pilot project. And my understanding is they operate in Bangui and its environs. So that essentially there are no police and gendarmes. There's no law enforcement outside of Bangui. Obviously, Misca and Sangaris are providing military presence outside, but that's not the same thing. And there is a fundamental difference, of course, and it does get to the issue of how does the military operate in these unconventional situations. Well, sometimes it doesn't operate well because it does not have the training of crowd control and things like that. And it again speaks to the issue of the importance of strengthening not only the UN police presence, which will be 1,800, but also longer term getting the CAR police and gendarmes back on the streets. In terms of attracting extremists, we have noted very significant activity on jihadi websites that make reference to what's occurring in the Central African Republic. The conflict in the Central African Republic in a positive sense has also attracted the attention of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which sent a representative for the first time to the last contact group meeting that was held in March. This past week, there was a high-level delegation from the OIC that visited Bangui, and so it is an issue of concern, and their engagement with other donors, I think, is a very positive development. Why hasn't it attracted extremists? I think part of it, well, first of all, it has. I mean, and the LRA has been there for several years. If you're talking about extremists such as Boko Haram, some people fear that it's a matter of time if we don't take action and help the government to reestablish state authority, that they will, this ungoverned space, they will move into it. So it's a large country. It's quite a ways away from the extremists have been operating in the Sahel, such as AQIM. It's far away from Boko Haram's northern Nigeria center of gravity, if you will. But the concern, again, is that there could be an extremist presence in the future. And in terms of the third question, military mission, what is the strategy? There's no functioning state. Well, I mean, I can't speak to the precise details of their concept of operation, et cetera, but this is an integrated UN mission that has already started to take over. Their focus is, of course, reestablishing security. They did have a three-phased military plan that was leading into elections that had been planned, or still are planned, for February 2015. The timing of those elections is a separate issue of great interest and importance. The ability of them to carry out this overall objective, reestablishing security in the country, which is, again, linked to so many things, the humanitarian response, the restarting of the economy, including the planting season. All these things have been negatively impacted by the lack of security. The health system, the 70% of schools remain closed, and that's also related to security. An important issue right now is troop and police generation, finding other countries that are willing to send troops and police. That's a really core issue right now. I think it's less a problem of donors being able to come up with money, although that is a major issue. It's more trying to find countries that are willing to contribute. So that's a challenge that the UN and certain donors countries, including ourselves, are looking at right now.
Thanks very much. I completely agree, Sarah, and just to highlight the need for there to eventually be local law enforcement to actually have sustained stability. We were driving north out of Bangui, just kind of on the outskirts of the city. Every few kilometers, there was an anti-block roadblock, and we were able to get through them. But some of them were a little more intimidating than others. But kind of moving through each village, and as you get further away, there were fewer of them. And on the way back into town, we saw the French Sangres physically disarming anti-blocka. They had them thrown against the wall. They were taking down roadblocks. They were trying to eliminate this sort of ad hoc, localized security system. And so that day, all the roadblocks were taken down. The very next day, the roadblocks were back up again. The anti-blocka were harassing civilians and NGOs trying to drive through. Even though the French had tried to engage in disarmament then, because there was no local security structure to take the place, anti-blocka were right back up again. So it's a tough situation in the short term.
Let's take some more questions.
Ari, thank you. Mike Jagiets. How we can deploy the capabilities that are much needed as quickly as possible, and then the question about military strategy, how to empower them so that they can effectively protect civilians. I guess my questions primarily will be directed at David. First part, I looked on the website for U4RCA, and there's no mention of any capabilities there whatsoever. So my question is, has the European Gendarmerie Force been approached, and are they willing, and I don't know, so this is a force of gendarme-like capabilities from Europe that is intended to be rapidly deployable. So that could be done now if they make the decision. And I don't know if we've implored them to do that yet. But the of the 1,800 police that are in the mandate for September deployment are 1,400 foreign police units. And so that's 10 units. The chronic problem is how do we mobilize them? But there is a very simple solution. And that's these units, they're police units. They require three armored personnel carriers. What police forces have armored personnel carriers, and then Humvee, you know, Hummer-type vehicles. The United States is giving away or selling to locals, police forces, MRAPs. The military has a surplus, and they're trying to unload them and get rid of them. Well, you know, we would save money if we just donated to the United States, you know, about 50 or 60 armored personnel carriers to outfit 10 units. And by the way, if we give them away, the countries earn $4.5 million every year. So, and there are countries with a surplus of police. Nepal is one, and they have very credible foreign police units, and they've got a disposal problem with their police force after the war. So there are some very simple fixes if they were pursued. And by the way, I've talked to Mike Smith about this in GPOI. I'd be happy to follow up. Now, how are you going to use them once you get the capability? That's the critical question. The mandate 2149 has serious lacunae. And you've all mentioned that there is, it's anarchic. There is no legal system. The mandate calls for MANUCA to support investigation, to contribute to arrest. Who's going to arrest them? And then what are you going to do with them? There's no court system to try them. Now, we're talking about international humanitarian law and human rights violations. Why don't we revise the mandate immediately to have the international community enforce international law? That's the only mandate that we need, is to enforce international law. Set up a special court hybrid that does mention the International Criminal Court, but if those cases are taken out of the country, oh, by the way, the mandate also mentions that there's impunity that reigns in the legal system. So it knows that the legal system can't function, it's dysfunctional, impunity reigns, and the only solution would be to take the cases out of the country. If we actually formed a special court with a majority of internationals and minority of selected and protected locals, then you could begin to create a system that might then assist with that transition to a functioning legal system.
Thank you. Jeff Crisp from Refugees International. Quick question for my colleague Mark. We've heard a lot about internal displacement within CAR, but perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the refugee dimension, both in terms of CAR citizens who have left the country, but also anything you know about the existing refugee population inside CAR. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, in terms of the UN Security Council Resolution 2149, there actually is a provision that speaks ambiguously, intentionally ambiguously, because of the negotiations, about extraordinary measures and extraordinary powers of the United Nations. Actually, the United Nations is, I believe it's this week, certainly very soon, is to have a meeting with the CAR government to talk about how to delineate the extraordinary authorities that will be given to the United Nations. As I did allude to, there is a plan to have United Nations, the FPUs that obviously being a part of MISCA, but also international magistrates, international corrections officials, working with their CAR counterparts. So they're actually, I think the likely outcome will be that there will be an understanding and accord between the United Nations and the CAR government delineating these extraordinary powers that the UN will have. And the second, well, I don't know whether my colleagues want to respond to the first one or go to the internews. All right. In terms of InterNews, InterNews, I think, has done fantastic work in the Central African Republic. We're delighted to have you as a partner there, and your comment about rumors is absolutely the spot on. In terms of the comment about a lack of a common strategy, I think you're also right. In fact, that's we've had discussions in the last few days, separate discussions with the bank, with the UN, with the EU, and with France. And that is one of the themes that came out. We will be meeting in Brussels in a matter of a few days, and we hope to have expert-level discussions, which hopefully will make some progress in coordinating efforts, which up to now have not been well coordinated. I mean, the French are working on, the Europeans and maybe France as well, Fondation Hirondelle, Internews and Mercy Corps and Search for Common Ground and the UN effort. So it has not, I think you're right, it hasn't been well coordinated, but hopefully moving forward they will be.
Just briefly on the refugee situation. I mean, our trip focused primarily on what's happening inside the country, but there's obviously been a major exodus to the neighboring countries. There's currently over 350,000 refugees living in neighboring countries, and I know PRM's been quite engaged in visiting each of the areas. And there's some places in Cameroon where refugees are living with host families and creating a general strain, I think, on overall resources. There's other places like in Congo and Republic of Congo, where refugees are moving back into they're moving into tents of previous refugees from previous caseloads and are in pretty old facilities. Antonio Guterres made a comment just a week or two ago that the operation for funding refugee situation in the region was running out of money and was about to go broke. And so it sounds like quite a dire situation in terms of the funding for refugees. At the same time, speaking with people who are working on the response, I think they found the comment a bit frustrating, whether UNHCR is spending the money most efficiently, given the numbers of staff that are sent on conferences and first class flights. It was sort of received a bit cynically, but it's quite a tough refugee situation.
Yes, good morning. This is Scott Morgan with Red Eagle Enterprises. Thank you for an excellent presentation. I have a quick two-part question, though. First part is, we've heard about food insecurity. What about potable water? That has to be a major concern as well, and you don't really hear anybody discussing access to water, whether it's clean and safe to drink or not. And the second is about, you know, we've heard somebody asked about the extremists. What about the foreign fighters? We know that a key element of the Seleka fighters were rebels from southern Chad and fought were members of the Janjaweed in Darfur. And now we know that we had there's evidence that some of the anti-Balakas are actually Christians coming over from both Congo. So how do you restore stability in the CAR and yet find out who is actually from the CAR, who is actually a foreign fighter, and repatriate them back to their host countries?
Yes, my question is, I know that the researchers are not really trained about a domain called high politics, the intersection between spirituality and politics. But given what I heard here, and given the fact of what is happening in this last two decades around the world, how can you be sure that this conflict is not really a religious conflict? And it doesn't have any ramification throughout the world, including here in the U.S.
Okay, in terms of the first set of questions about potable water and foreign fighters, I'll leave the potable water one to my colleagues if they want to respond on that one. In terms of the foreign fighters, let's just say that right now it's an unclear picture of how many foreign fighters may have returned. The Seleka left power in January, and even preceding that, once the French military operation got started, a lot of the foreign fighters, even before that, because they realized the French were coming, started to leave the country. So we don't have a lot of good visibility into how many might have returned. I think probably not a significant, well, if anything, a relatively small fraction of the ones that were still there, but I could be wrong on that. It's obviously an important issue we'll look at. In terms of the religious issues. This is an issue that's very close to my heart because it's one that I've done a lot of thinking about. I stated that at its origin, this was not about religion. I do strongly believe that. And within our government, I was an early and strong advocate of bringing in religious leaders into that. And I'll give you a couple examples. One, for example, in Carr, a problem that certainly precedes the Celica's arrival has been tensions between, for example, pastoralists and agriculturalists. And what you're seeing is not a religious phenomenon, but you're seeing the coincidence of an overlap between Pul, who are mainly Muslim, and the agriculturalists, who are Christian, in some cases animist. And so it on the surface, it may look like this is about religion, but this so-called transhumance problem of the movement of cattle across agricultural lands and the tensions that brings about and the that Pol tend to be often they're armed, and this has led to conflicts that preceded this issue. There have also been tensions that are very real and really need to be addressed about the treatment of the Muslim community on the one hand and the Christian community. What I mean by that is, for example, historically, there has been discrimination against the Muslim community in terms of access to government jobs, in terms of education, so much that many Muslim families decided to name their children with Christian first names. And there's been a perception of neglect by the central government of primarily Muslim regions in the north. To some extent, that has reflected the dysfunction of the Carr state itself, and there's also been neglect of non-Muslim areas by the central government. But at least the perception in the Muslim areas is one of state neglect. And, you know, having spoken with Jatoja and Noordina Dam personally, one-on-one, about their sentiments, I certainly heard that from them and from other Muslims. On the other hand, there are perceptions of, I think historically, one reason that Muslim population has been very strong in commercial activities and trade is because they have been excluded from other opportunities. Yet their dominance of commercial trade has created resentments among the Christian population. So, you know, from a political science point of view, is it really about religion or is it really about discrimination of certain Muslim groups? I mean, I think there is some element of religion in there for sure. And with the violence that has occurred, this vicious cycle of attacks that were, when the Celica originally came in, they spared the Muslim community. They could communicate in Arabic, the foreign fighters. And there was a perception that the Christian community, non-Muslim communities, were being targeted. And now you're seeing the revenge. And so this vicious cycle of hatred has gotten a lot worse. And therefore, the religious hue, as I like to put it, has become very, very visible. But again, at its origins, I don't think it's really fundamentally about religion. It's more about economic opportunity, about political power, those sorts of issues.
My name is Eva Konglu. I'm the president of Central African Republic Renaissance Foundation, and I was born in CAR. My parents worked for the government in CAR, so I know the country pretty well and politics and stuff. As far as the religious issue, I can confirm this is not a religious issue. The mistake that the international community is doing is that they're treating the issue of the current crisis. They're not looking backwards or how things have started. So back in the days, like 20 years ago, it was an issue between the North and the South. Today, if people look at it as a religious issue, it's because the religion is being a substitute for ethnic in CAR. And there's never been any animosity between the Christian and the Muslim. It's only that if you ask anybody about Ibrahim, what region Ibrahim is from, they're going to say he's Muslim. And what they're trying to say here is that they don't know exactly their origin, besides saying that they're Muslim. So it's not a religious issue. is more a political and an issue of being marginalized. Back in the days under General Kolingba in the 80s to the beginning of the 90s, there were a lot of Muslim in involved in the government, involved in the politics. After the General Kolingba, the country was divided between the North and the South. And because the Muslim were working well with people from the South, then they've been pushed aside. And this is where everything has started.
Yeah, I'm sorry, one thing I didn't really comment to the question that, that Richard posed. What is the U.S. government, for example, doing about it? I think we've been doing a lot, and we've actually been, I would say, leading in terms of the international donor community on this issue, although our friends are also doing more. And I think it also fundamentally relates to American perceptions of the role of religion in our society. Early on, we received a request from the three religious leaders for funding. That has, in turn, been converted to a very small amount of money, $125,000, into a grant to search for common ground and perhaps other partners. In January, we organized a televideo conference covered by the press between U.S. religious leaders and the so-called religious platform of Archbishop, of the Archbishop of Bangui, the president of evangelicals, the Protestants, as well as Imam Kubini Layama, who is the president of a national Muslim association in the Central African Republic. We followed on that video conference with a visit, a bilateral or binational visit of religious leaders, which occurred on October 8th. The U.S. delegation was composed of Cardinal McCarrick, who was the Archbishop of Washington. Some of you may know him. The president of the National Evangelical Association in this country, representing the Protestants, and the president of the Islamic Society of North America, which also includes Canada, as well as President Obama's special envoy to the OIC. I was also present in that. And we had symbolic meetings at a mosque in Bangui. Unfortunately, we originally planned to have it at the Central Mosque, but there is a deep division right now in the country within the Muslim community. And we are actually, as a follow-up to that visit, trying to assist in mediation. I should say that's really the Islamic Society of North America, which is taking the lead in that, but we're supporting that. Right now, in Bangui, there are only 5 of 37 mosques remain standing. This speaks to the issue of taking on a religious hue. It wasn't at its origin about religion, but unfortunately, one's religion has, as the ethno-religious partition of the country attests, it's taken on a great importance. And it has to be factored in how we think about peace and reconciliation in the future. It's a tragic situation. You imagine 32 out of 37 places of worship for religion have been desecrated and destroyed in this way. We also had a symbolic prayers, again, bilaterally, the six religious leaders at the cathedral. We met with President Samba Panza, who stated to us that she welcomed the initiative and saw it as a step towards an eventual grassroots-led national conference effort, which is still evolving as a concept. And we also had a closed-door session where we brought together prominent Seleka, anti-Balaka leaders, as well as civil society and government leaders, and shared with them and developed with them a communique, really a declaration in favor of peace and reconciliation. And all this was covered by the media. And we're trying to organize a follow-up event for the three U.S. religious leaders. So this is, in an important issue for us. We want to be supportive, and we recognize this religious dimension as well as the fundamental sort of political economy dimensions to the conflict.
Kara, maybe, and Mark, if you had I'll pass it to
Kara, because I mean, there's groups that are on the ground in certain areas, especially in the IDP camps, like ICRC providing potable water, but I'll let Kara discuss more broadly the efforts.
Sure. Just briefly on that question, we did mention food security kind of as a standalone, but I would say that certainly is not the only acute humanitarian need right now. And to avoid singling out some and leaving out the others, I would say among the top humanitarian response needs right now include access to basic health services, both for those that may have been injured in attacks, but also those who need access to basic health services. We've already mentioned the food security needs. Water, as well as accompanying sanitation and hygiene services, is definitely a need, particularly for the populations that have been displaced and are still sheltering in really inhospitable environments, either in Bangui or other areas outside of the capital. Add to that the need for protection services, and that's the humanitarian protection services in terms of access, whether it's to basic health services for survivors of attacks, also referral services if they need additional care, as well as psychosocial to begin hopefully talking about and dealing with the events that have happened. Protection services also could include those for children that have become separated from their families or communities and trying to retrace or reconnect them. And then that's also not to leave out the need for shelter, both for populations that have been displaced, but also for those, there are cases of some households trying to return and to homes and communities that have been entirely burned or looted and need support that way. As well as the need for ongoing relief supplies for those that either, again, remain displaced or are hoping to return and rebuild their lives at some point. And just to tie this also to the question on the conditions of refugees, the needs and acute humanitarian emergency needs certainly extend to the refugee population, which Mark has already cited. And I'll just add that we are unfortunately seeing reports that the conditions of refugee populations and others that are crossing international borders outside of CAR are deteriorating in recent months, which due to, I think, the challenging access throughout the country, it's difficult to confirm this, but I think it's easy to take that to point to deteriorating conditions among the population inside the country as well. In addition to the combined appeal coordinated by OCHA for assistance inside the country, which is looking for $551 million. There also has been a more recent combined appeal for the regional refugee effort, which calls for an additional $247 million on top of that. So just want to emphasize both of those are significant factors in the ongoing crisis.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I would just sort of pose rhetorically the question of how to seek reconciliation moving forward. And I think the various communities are going to have to reach out to the other. And specifically, the issue of the constitutional referendum. I've heard troubling reports that because the members of the Transitional National Council who are Muslim have fled the capital, that there have not been any Muslims involved in the redrafting of the Constitution. We've heard reports of concern among elites from that community about their exclusion from this process. And although I think by the reports that I've seen, the quality of the CAR Constitution, even before the crisis began, was quite high. So I suspect that the number of modifications that they're talking about are not that significant. But if you're not making a special effort to reach out to this other important community, they're not going to be supportive of this. And so we could be heading towards another problem that should be solvable, namely rejection or repudiation of whatever constitution is proposed to the electorate before the election. So that's both sides are going to have to be bigger, recognize errors of the past. I was struck by the visit before my last visit, that a lot of the elites that I spoke with, almost exclusively Muslim, I only had a chance to speak with a couple Muslims because, frankly, there are so few of them left at that point. And there does not seem to be a recognition that in the past things were not perfect, that there were problems, that there was discrimination, that there was exclusion, that there were perhaps trade practices which were also, in the other sense, not fair or excluded other communities. So I think we need to have great leadership. I do believe that Samba Panza is an extraordinary leader for the Central African Republic, someone who understands the sort of issues I'm talking about now, is not stuck in the old think, and was elected because there was a perception that she can unite the country. And so moving forward, supporting her, supporting people who think like her and can bring the country together is very important.
Thanks very much, David. And Mark, final word.
No, again, thank you all for being here and the CIS for putting a spotlight on the issue. And just be very happy to stay in touch with anyone in the room on these issues. And USAID as well, I appreciate being here. I just wanted to thank you for participating.
Great, thank you. And copies of your report are outside, I think, if there are any left, for those who want to pick it up. And there's still
none left. Okay.
We can send
you copies. Yeah, it's riveting stuff, so I'll send it to you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that, look, I want to thank all of our panelists for taking part and for attending this morning. And let's continue the conversation on CAR as the following months progress, and we stay focused on it. Thank you very much for coming this morning. And join me in thanking our guests.